and went critical for the first time on December 13, 1983. The work left little time for hobbies, but somehow Toptanov managed to fit them in. When he and Karol had first arrived in Pripyat, Toptanov organized a gym downstairs in the dormitories where they lived. He put up a set of Swedish wall bars for everyone to use, and later, a class in which he tutored high school students from the city in math and physics. He had a girlfriend who worked as a nurse at the Pripyat Hospital, Medical Sanitary Center number 126, and he loved to go fishing. The network of artificial canals and the giant cooling reservoir around the station were rich in fish, which thrived in water that had circulated through the plant's reactors as coolant before being flushed, still radioactive but pleasingly warm, toward the river. After serving his apprenticeship by helping to build the reactor he would one day operate, Toptanov grew closer to qualifying as a senior reactor control engineer. This was perhaps the most demanding job in the entire plant, as the man, even in the nominally egalitarian Soviet Union, it was always a man, who, minute by minute, through each 8-hour shift, governed the enormous power of the reactor. The position required rigorous study and practical experience. The operators spoke their own coded language, dense with acronyms and apparently unpronounceable abbreviations, that were muddled into a new vocabulary. The Zagis and the Mavta, the Beshao, the Siur, the Siut, and the Siub. Then there were thick stacks of manuals and regulations to pore over, followed by a series of examinations in the station's Department of Nuclear Safety. There were also health checks and security screenings conducted by the KGB. After one of these safety exams, Toptanov sat down with Karol and told him about a strange phenomenon described deep in the RBMK documentation, indicating that the reactor control rods may, under some circumstances, accelerate reactivity instead of slowing it down. Only after all of this study and practice was Toptanov permitted to stand behind an existing senior reactor control engineer at the reactor panel in the control room and watch how the work was done. Eventually, he was allowed, still under close supervision, to begin touching the buttons and switches of the panel himself. When Leonid Toptanov let himself into Alexander Karol's 8th-floor apartment late on the night of April 25, 1986, he'd been qualified as a senior reactor control engineer for just 2 months. Karol, still an assistant, was behind him but hoping to qualify soon as a senior engineer in the Unit 4 reactor department. Toptanov found his old friend lounging on the couch, reading a story about a new medical phenomenon discovered in the United States, AIDS, in a recent Russian edition of Scientific American. Leonid told him that there was an electrical test on the turbines scheduled during his shift at reactor number 4 that night. It would be worth witnessing. "Let's go together," Toptanov said. "No, I'll pass," Karol replied. "I've got this interesting article to read." At a few minutes before 11 that night, Toptanov set off for the bus stop, a few blocks away on Kurchatov Street, where a scheduled service shuttled workers to and from the plant. He walked down to the end of Sportivnaya and took a right at the darkened windows of the Jubilee Home Services store. Then on past the post office and the technical school and across the square toward the end of Lenina Prospect. It was a warm, sultry night, the sky in inky blue, glittering with stars. On the bus, Toptanov joined his colleagues on the midnight shift in Unit 4. These included the control room staff, Senior Unit Control Engineer Boris Stolyachuk and Shift Foreman Alexander Akimov, and the engineers from the reactor department, among them Leonid's friend Alexander Yuvchenko wearing his new clothes. It was a short ride. After 10 minutes, they were at the steps of the station's main administrative block. The 4-story office building sat, like the bridge of a massive container ship, at the extreme eastern edge of the station's 4 reactors and the turbine hall, which stretched away into the distance, a narrow concrete box almost a kilometer long. Inside the administrative block were the offices of Viktor Bruhanov and his senior staff, and one of the plant's 2 main radiation control points, the sanitary locks that marked the barrier between the plant's clean and dirty or potentially radioactive zones. Taking the polished marble stairs to the 2nd floor, past stained glass panels depicting life-size modernist figures in brilliant shades of yellow, scarlet, and cobalt blue, Toptanov and the others arrived at the double doors of the men's sanitary lock. Inside, a narrow bench painted with the instruction, "Take off your shoes," blocked his path. He sat, removed his footwear, swung his legs over the bench, and walked to the changing room in his socks. He hung his clothes in a narrow steel locker and passed through the door into the dirty room, wearing just his underpants. Once this door closed behind him, the only way back into the clean room was through a radiation monitoring device equipped with sensors to detect alpha and beta particle contamination. Toptonov put on freshly laundered white cotton overalls, a white cotton cap like those worn in an operating theater to protect his hair, and white canvas boots. The Chernobyl plant was constructed with a utilitarian disregard for high-minded notions of architecture. Its form followed function in the most economical ways the station's designers could conceive. The turbine hall housed the station's 8 colossal steam turbines in a single row, end-to-end in a cavernous shed 30 meters high and roofed with corrugated steel. The plant's 4 reactors were strung out in a line along the length of the turbine hall, giant concrete boxes arranged in the order they had been constructed, from 1 to 4. The first 2 reactors were housed in separate structures, but to save time and money, reactor number 3 and reactor number 4 had been built together, back-to-back under the same roof where they shared ventilation and auxiliary systems. Between the turbine hall and the reactors was the spine of the station, which housed the deaerator corridor. Uninterrupted by a single door or dogleg, this seemingly endless hallway ran parallel to the turbine hall, all the way from the main administrative block at one end of the plant to the western end of reactor number 4 at the other, not quite a kilometer long in total. The deaerator corridor provided the plant staff with access to every part of the station, including each of the 4 unit control rooms, one dedicated to each reactor, that lay along it. It was also a key orientation point inside a complex that, with its dark spaces and tang of machine oil, often resembled the dark, roaring voids inside a gargantuan submarine more than an ordinary building. Much of it was navigated along catwalks and clanging steel stairwells, lined with hundreds of kilometers of dense pipework and accessed through heavy steel doors. The layout could be bewildering, and workers found their bearings inside the plant using alphanumeric coordinates lettered in Russian from A to Ya along one axis, and along the other by numbers from 1 to 68. Instead of conventional floors, the levels of the plant were subdivided vertically by mark numbers, showing distance in meters from the ground and painted on the walls of hallways and landings in large red figures. Climbing from mark negative 5 in the basement to the station's highest point at mark plus 74.5, the roof of the reactor block, the structure stood more than 20 stories high. To reach control room number 4, Toptonov, Stolyachuk, Akimov, and the other men on the night shift had to ascend to mark plus 10, 10 meters above ground level, and then travel almost the entire length of the deaerator corridor, a brisk 10-minute walk from one end of the station to the other. From there, the floor of the Unit 4 central reactor hall was higher still, up several flights of stairs or by elevator from the control room to mark plus 35, or more than 10 stories above ground. Here, accessible through a heavy airtight door that could be sealed shut against radiation, lay the shining steel lid of reactor number 4. A little more than 500 meters away from control room number 4, on the other side of the access road that ran beside the plant, the men of the 3rd Watch of Paramilitary Fire Brigade number 2 lingered outside their fire station. Their cigarettes glowed in the mellow darkness. It had been a quiet day. As midnight approached, the 14 firefighters were more than halfway through their 24-hour shift and taking turns to sleep in the ready room. They were not due to be relieved until 8 the next morning. The brigade was one of 2 based close to the Chernobyl plant. Pripyat also had its own paramilitary firefighting crew, Brigade No. 6, who lived beside their station in a large 2-story building near the end of Lesi Ukranki Street. They had already been called out earlier in the evening to a blaze reported on the roof of the city bus station, but that had taken the civilian firefighters less than 5 minutes to put out, and they were soon back at home. Brigade number 2 was dedicated to protecting the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, but there was never much action. The construction work, conducted by shifts of several thousand men day and night across the complex, would sometimes cause small fires. Welders' sparks might set light to a pile of trash, or a vat of hot bitumen could be knocked over. The fire station, with offices, a canteen, the ready room with a TV set, and the recreation room with a ping-pong table, was within easy reach of the plant and the building sites. The red and white striped ventilation stack between reactors 1 and 2 dominated the view through the large glass doors at the front of the station. Between the doors sat four fire trucks, compact Zill 130s, and the bigger six-wheeled Zill 131 powder trucks that could carry 2,400 liters of water and 150 liters of foam for smothering electrical fires. At the back of the building was a separate garage holding the special equipment, including a Ural mobile fire tanker capable of pumping 40 liters of water a second. The third watch lacked discipline. It was packed with obstinate old hands who disliked following orders. Many of them were from peasant families, close relatives raised in the surrounding countryside. Among them were two Shavri brothers, Ivan and Leonid, from just over the border in Belarus, and 50-year-old Grandpa Grigory Chmel, who had two sons who were also firefighters, all of them born in a small village 10 kilometers away from where the station now stood. The watch commander, Lieutenant Vladimir Pravik, was just 23, a college graduate who dabbled in photography, drawing, and poetry, and was a dedicated member of the Komsomol. His wife taught music at a kindergarten in Pripyat, and had given birth to their first child, a daughter, just a few weeks before, at the end of March. That morning, Pravik had applied to take the day off, offering to switch shifts with his friend Pyotr Chmel, chief of the first watch, with whom he'd graduated from the Fire Safety Institute in Cherkasy. Pyotr, the younger son of Grandpa Chmel, was a burly, good-natured 24-year-old lieutenant. Chmel had already covered for Pravik after his daughter's birth, and that morning he had been there again with his uniform on, ready to go. But the deputy station commander wouldn't approve the change. "Major Telyatnikov will be back from his holiday on Monday," he told Pravik. "He'll give you permission." Chmel went home to get some rest and prepare for work on Saturday, and Pravik once again took command of the troublesome third watch. Back in Pripyat, Pyotr decided to take advantage of his unexpected night off and joined three fellow officers from the fire station for dinner at the restaurant in the city's new shopping center. Despite General Secretary Gorbachev's ongoing union-wide campaign against alcohol, they had no trouble getting a bottle of vodka. Later, they moved on to Sovietskoy Champanskoy, the cheap, mass-produced people's champagne originally developed on the orders of Stalin. At around 11, they went up to Chmel's one-room apartment in the old low-rise blocks just across the street from the Pripyat fire station. They invited a few girls over to keep the party going. It was well after midnight when Chmel's guests departed, leaving behind a little chocolate and a half-finished bottle of Soviet champagne on the kitchen table. Tired and drunk, Chmel took a shower and prepared for bed. Over at the power station, senior mechanical engineer Alexander Yuvchenko was already at his post, a large, windowless space at mark plus 12.5 in a mezzanine between the reactor halls of units 3 and 4. He had a desk there for his papers and a metal cage stacked with equipment and supplies. Although he hadn't slept in 24 hours, he was expecting a quiet night. Earlier in the day, the reactor had been scheduled for a maintenance shutdown following a series of long-overdue tests on the turbines. By the time he arrived at work, he understood that everything in Unit 4 would be powered down. All he and the others on the graveyard shift would be doing was overseeing the cooling of the reactor. Easy work. But down in the control room, there had been a change of plans. The tests were running 12 hours late and were only now beginning in earnest. The impatience of the station's deputy chief engineer was rising, and there was mounting disagreement about how to respond to the troubling data coming in from reactor number 4. 4. Secrets of the Peaceful Atom. On September 29, 1966, the Soviet Council of Ministers in Moscow issued a decree approving the construction of the first in a new generation of giant water and graphite nuclear reactors, which would become known by the acronym RBMK, the Reaktor Bolshoi Moshnosti Kanalny, or High Power Channel Type Reactor. Developed from the Ministry of Medium Machine Building's military workhorse, the plutonium and power-producing Ivan II, it was a direct descendant of the pioneering Atom Mirny 1 reactor, reimagined on an Olympian scale. 12 meters across and 7 meters high, the core of the RBMK was a massive cylinder, larger than a two-story house, composed of more than 1,700 tons of moderating graphite blocks and stacked into 2,488 separate columns, each drilled from top to bottom with a circular channel. These channels contained more than 1,600 heat-resistant zirconium alloy pressure tubes, each of which held a pair of metal assemblies packed with sealed rods of fuel, 190 tons of enriched uranium dioxide compressed into ceramic pellets roughly the diameter of a man's little finger. Once the reactor went critical and the uranium began to heat, releasing the energy of nuclear fission, the fuel assemblies were cooled by water pumped into the core from below. Under enormous pressure, 69 atmospheres or 1,000 pounds per square inch, the water rose to 280 degrees centigrade and turned to a mixture of water and superheated steam, which was then piped out through the top of the reactor to giant separator drums. These directed the steam to turbines to generate electricity, while the remaining water returned to the beginning of the coolant loop to start its journey through the core once more. The power of the reactor was regulated by 211 boron carbide-filled control rods, most around 5 meters long, which could be raised or lowered into the reactor core to increase or decrease the rate of the nuclear chain reaction, and thus the level of heat and energy it generated. To help protect the plant and its staff from the radiation seething within, the reactor core, the active zone, was surrounded by a massive annular tank filled with water, contained within a steel jacket and surrounded by a giant box packed with sand. All this was further encased in a concrete vault more than 8 stories high and crowned with a diadem of metal boxes filled with a mixture of iron shot and the neutron-retarding mineral serpentinite. A biological shield, a shallow stainless steel drum 17 meters across and 3 meters deep, known as Structure E, or more affectionately, Elena, sat on top of the vault like a giant lid. Filled with pebbles and rocks of serpentinite and nitrogen gas, Elena weighed 2,000 tons, as much as 6 fully laden jumbo jets, and was held in place almost entirely by gravity. Pierced by ducts providing passage for the fuel channels and surmounted by hundreds of narrow pipes carrying away steam and water, Elena was concealed beneath 2,000 removable steel-clad concrete blocks, which capped the vertical fuel channels and formed the floor of the reactor hall. This tessellated metal circle, the visible face of the reactor during day-to-day operation, was known by the plant staff as the Piatichok, or 5 kopeck piece. The RBMK was a triumph of Soviet gigantomania, a testament to its creator's unrelenting pursuit of economies of scale. 20 times the size of Western reactors by volume, it was capable of producing 3,200 megawatts of thermal energy, or 1,000 megawatts of electricity, enough to keep the lights on for half the population of Kiev. Soviet scientists proclaimed it the national reactor of the USSR, not only technologically unique, but the largest in the world. Anatoly Alexandrov, the bald-headed director of the Kurchatov Institute of Atomic Energy, had personally taken credit for its design, which he filed as a classified invention with the Soviet Patent Office. In contrast to its principal Soviet competitor, the Vovir, a complex piece of engineering derided by its detractors as the American reactor because of its similarity to the pressurized water reactors favored in the United States, the parts of the RBMK could be made in existing factories and didn't require any specialized tooling. Its modular construction, hundreds of graphite blocks stacked into columns, meant that it could easily be put together on-site and scaled up to become even more powerful if necessary. Alexandrov also saved money by dispensing with the containment building, the thick concrete dome built around almost every reactor in the West, intended to prevent radioactive contamination escaping from the plant in the event of a serious accident, but which, because the RBMK was so enormous, would have doubled the cost of building each unit. The subdivision of the reactor into 1,600 pressure tubes was adopted as a less costly solution, designed to contain each pair of fuel assemblies in their own thin metal jacket, a feat of Byzantine plumbing that, its inventors argued, made a serious incident exceedingly unlikely. They also devised an accident suppression system that could cope safely with a simultaneous rupture in one or two of these tubes by safely directing the resulting release of high-pressure radioactive steam downward through a series of valves and into giant water-filled tanks in the basement beneath the reactor, where it would be cooled and securely contained. A break in the pressure tubes was one of the worst accidents the designers had ever prepared to encounter with the RBMK, a so-called Maximalna Proyektnaya Avaria, or Maximum Design Basis Accident. This designation also encompassed other potential calamities, including earthquakes, a plane crashing into the plant, or a complete rupture in one of the large diameter water pipes in the reactor coolant circuit, which would deprive the core of water and trigger a meltdown. To guard against this last eventuality, the designers devised an emergency cooling system powered by compressed nitrogen gas, and reactor operators at every level of the industry were drilled to maintain a continuous supply of water to the core at all costs. Worse accidents were theoretically possible, of course. Engineering calculations suggested that if more than two, and as few as three or four, of the 1,600 pressure tubes ruptured simultaneously, the sudden release of high-pressure steam would be enough to lift all 2,000 tons of Elena and the Piatichuk off their mounts, severing every one of the remaining steam lines and pressure tubes and resulting in a devastating explosion. Yet the designers saw no need to prepare for such a calamity, which they regarded as outside the realm of reasonable probability. Nonetheless, they granted the scenario its own designation, the Beyond Design Basis Accident. The Ministry of Medium Machine Building ordered the first draft plans of the RBMK to be drawn up by a heavy machinery plant in Leningrad, which also built tanks and tractors. But when they received the blueprints, Sredmash dismissed them as technically unsound. One scientist from the Kurchatov Institute warned that the design was too dangerous to be put into civilian operation. Another recognized that the hazards of the positive void coefficient made the new reactor inherently prone to explosion, and although his superiors attempted to have him dismissed from the Institute because of his dissent, he began a letter-writing campaign that eventually reached the Central Committee of the Communist Party and the Soviet Council of Ministers. But by then, the government, adhering to the rigid needs of central economic planning, had already issued its decree that four of the new behemoth reactors be built. So the designers of Nikiot scrambled to perform a drastic overhaul on the RBMK blueprints, transforming it from a schizoid contraption that could manufacture both plutonium and electricity into a tame generator of power for the civilian grid. Implementing these modifications was difficult and complex work and took far longer than expected. Primitive Soviet computing technology made calculating the expected performance of the reactor laborious and produced unreliable results. It was not until 1968 that the new reactor design, now called the RBMK-1000, was complete. So, to save time, Sredmash decided to skip the prototype stage entirely. The quickest way to find out how the new reactors would work in industrial electricity generation would be to put them directly into mass production. Construction began on the first RBMK reactor in the Soviet Union at a Sredmash installation on the Gulf of Finland, outside Leningrad, in 1970. In the meantime, a pair of technical and economic institutes in Kiev considered possible locations for the first nuclear power station to be built in Ukraine, and quickly narrowed it down to two. When the first proposed site was earmarked for a fossil fuel plant, the Ukrainian Council of Ministers decreed that the Republic's new 2,000-megawatt atomic energy station would be constructed at the other, on a large patch of sandy riverbank near the village of Kopachi in the Kiev region, 14 kilometers from the town of Chernobyl. The first RBMK unit at the Leningrad station started up on December 21, 1973, just one day before Energetiki across the USSR celebrated their own national holiday, the Day of the Power Engineer. The proud fathers of the RBMK 1000, Anatoly Alexandrov of the Kurchatov Institute and Nikolai Dolezhal from Nikiot, were both there to witness it come to life. By then, building was also underway on a second unit in Leningrad, and construction workers had broken ground at RBMK stations in Chernobyl and Kursk. But the initial Leningrad reactor had not even reached full power when it became clear that the designers' determination to rush their brainchild from drawing board to full-scale production had come at a steep cost. Serious design faults dogged the RBMK from the outset. Many became apparent immediately. Others would take much longer to come to light. The first problem arose from the positive void coefficient, the drawback that made Soviet graphite water reactors susceptible to runaway chain reactions in the event of a loss of coolant, and that, in the RBMK, had been exacerbated by attempts to make the reactor cheaper to run. To make it more competitive with fossil energy power stations, the RBMK had been deliberately designed to maximize the electricity output of the uranium fuel it burned up. But it was only when they started up Leningrad Unit 1 that the designers discovered that the effects of the positive void coefficient grew worse as more of the fuel was burned. The longer it was in operation, the harder the reactor became to control. By the time it reached the end of each of its 3-year operational cycles and was shut down for preventive maintenance, the RBMK would be at its most unpredictable. The designers made modifications, but instabilities remained. Yet neither Alexandrov nor Dolezal sought to explore these problems further, nor even to fully understand them, and provided no safety analysis of the void coefficient in the manuals accompanying each reactor. The results of the experiments in Leningrad made it obvious that there were important differences between the way they had predicted the reactor would perform in theory and how it worked in practice. But the designers decided not to examine these results too closely. Even as it went into full-scale commercial operation, nobody knew how the RBMK would behave during a major accident. A second failing of the reactor resulted from its colossal size. The RBMK was so large that reactivity in one area of the core had only a loose relationship to that in another. The operators had to control it as if it were not a single unit, but several separate reactors in one. One specialist compared it to a huge apartment building where a family in one flat might be celebrating a raucous wedding, while next door another was observing a funeral wake. Isolated hotspots of reactivity might build deep inside the core where they could prove hard to detect. This problem was especially pronounced during startup and shutdown when the reactor was operating at low power, and the systems designed to detect reactivity within the core proved unreliable. During these crucial periods, the engineers at their desks in the control room became almost totally blind to what was happening inside the active zone. Instead of reading their instruments, they were forced to estimate the levels of activity in the core using experience and intuition. This made startup and shutdown the most demanding and treacherous stages of RBMK operation. A third fault lay in the heart of the reactor's emergency protection system, the last line of defense against an accident. If the operators faced a situation calling for an emergency shutdown, a major coolant leak, or a runaway reactor, they could press the scram button, activating the ultimate stage of the unit's 5-level rapid power reduction system, known in Russian as AZ-5. Pushing this button would drive a special bank of 24 neutron-absorbing boron carbide control rods, as well as every one of the remaining 187 manual or automatic control rods that remained withdrawn at the time, simultaneously into the core, quenching the chain reaction throughout the reactor. Yet the AZ-5 mechanism was not designed to bring about an abrupt emergency stop. Dolezal and the technicians of Nikiat believed that suddenly cutting off the electricity generated by the reactor would be disruptive to the operation of the Soviet grid, and they thought that such an immediate shutdown would be necessary only in the extremely unlikely event of a total loss of external power to the plant. So they designed the AZ-5 system to only gradually reduce the reactor's power to zero. Rather than dedicated emergency motors, the system was driven by the same electric servos that moved the manual reactor control rods, used by the operators to manage reactor power during normal operation. Starting from their fully withdrawn position above the reactor, it would take between 18 and 21 seconds for the AZ-5 rods to descend completely into the core. The designers hoped that the rod's slow speed would be compensated for by their great number. But 18 seconds is a long time in neutron physics, and an eternity in a nuclear reactor with a high positive void coefficient. Adding to this disquieting list of major design defects, the construction of the reactors also suffered from the shoddy workmanship that plagued Soviet industry. The full startup of Leningrad's reactor number 1 was delayed for almost a year after fuel assemblies became stuck in their channels and had to be returned to Moscow for repeated testing. The valves and flow meters in other RBMKs, used to regulate the crucial supply of water to each of the more than 1,600 uranium-filled channels, proved so unreliable that the operators in the control room often had no idea to what extent the reactors were being cooled, or if they were being cooled at all. Accidents were inevitable. On the night of November 30, 1975, just over a year after it had first reached full operating capacity, Unit 1 of the Leningrad nuclear power plant was being brought back online after scheduled maintenance when it began to run out of control. The AZ-5 emergency protection system was tripped, but before the chain reaction could be stopped, a partial meltdown occurred, destroying or damaging 32 fuel assemblies and releasing radiation into the atmosphere over the Gulf of Finland. It was the first major accident involving an RBMK reactor, and the Ministry of Medium Machine Building set up a commission to investigate what had gone wrong. Afterward, the official line was that a manufacturing defect had led to the destruction of a single fuel channel. But the commission knew otherwise. The accident was the result of the design faults inherent in the reactor and caused by an uncontrollable increase in the steam void coefficient. Sredmash suppressed the commission's findings and covered up the accident. The operators of other RBMK plants were never informed of its true causes. Nevertheless, the commission made several important recommendations to be applied to all RBMK 1000 reactors. Develop new safety regulations to protect them in the event of coolant loss. Analyze what would happen in the event of a sharp rise in steam in the core. And devise a faster-acting emergency protection system. Despite their apparent urgency, the reactor designers failed to act on a single one of these directives, and Moscow promptly ordered more of the reactors to be built. The day after the Leningrad meltdown, the Soviet Union's Council of Ministers gave its final approval to construct a second pair of RBMK 1000 units in Chernobyl, expanding the station's projected output to an impressive 4,000 megawatts. On August 1, 1977, more than 7 years after Viktor Bruhanov had watched the first stake being driven into the snow-covered ground beside the Pripyat, and 2 years later than planned, reactor number one of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant at last went critical. The plant's young operators were overwhelmed with pride as they prepared to bring the Ukrainian Republic's first nuclear station online. They remained at their posts day and night as the first fuel assemblies were loaded and the reactor was slowly brought up to full power and finally connected to the transformers. At 8:10 p.m. on September 27, the scientists and designers from the Kurchatov Institute and Nikiat joined the plant specialists to celebrate as Ukraine's first nuclear electricity ran into the 110 and 330 kilovolt lines and out to the Soviet grid. Together, they sang the couplet with which Atom Shiki across the Union hymned the success of the Soviet reactor, Apoka, Apoka, Tok Dayuk, RBMK. For today, current flows from the RBMK. But the Chernobyl operators soon discovered that the reactor on which they had lavished so much attention was an unforgiving mistress. The inherent instabilities of the RBMK made it so difficult to manage that the senior reactor control engineer's work proved not only mentally but also physically demanding. Making dozens of adjustments every minute, they were never off their feet and sweated like laborers digging a ditch. Rumors reached them that up in Leningrad, the Sredmash reactor engineers had doubled up on the control desk, playing duets to cope with the complexity of the task. The reactor operators worked the panel so hard that the switches governing the control rods quickly wore out and had to be replaced constantly. When one former nuclear submarine officer first took his seat at the desk in Chernobyl's Unit 1, he was horrified by the colossal size of the reactor and how antiquated the instrumentation was. "How can you possibly control this hulking piece of shit?" he asked. "And what is it doing in civilian use?" At their first planned maintenance shutdown, the Chernobyl operators found that the serpentine plumbing of the reactor was riddled with faults. The water steam coolant pipes were corroded, the zirconium steel joints on the fuel channels had come loose, and the designers had failed to build any safety system to protect the reactor against a failure of its feed water supply. Eventually, the Chernobyl engineers had to design and fabricate their own. Meanwhile, in Moscow, the reactor designers continued to discover further troubling flaws in their creation. In 1980, Nikiat completed a confidential study that listed 9 major design failings and thermohydraulic instabilities which undermined the safety of the RBMK reactor. The report made it clear that accidents were not merely possible under rare and improbable conditions, but also likely in the course of everyday operation. Yet they took no action to redesign the reactor or even to warn plant personnel of its potential hazards. Instead of engineering new safety systems, Nikiat simply revised the operating instructions for the RBMK 1000. After decades of accident-free operation of military reactors, the atomic chieftains of Nikiat and the Kurchatov Institute apparently believed that a well-written set of manuals would be enough to guarantee nuclear safety. The designers assumed that so long as they followed the new instructions closely, human beings would act as promptly and unfailingly as any of the plant's electromechanical safety systems. But the staff of Soviet nuclear power plants, faced with ever-increasing production targets and constantly malfunctioning or inadequate equipment, and answerable to a bewildering and dysfunctional bureaucracy, had long become accustomed to bending or ignoring the rules in order to get their work done. And the updated instructions they received from Nikiat were neither explicit nor explained. One of the new directives stipulated that a minimum number of control rods should henceforth be maintained within the core at all times, but Nikiat did not emphasize that this limit on the operational reactivity margin, or ORM, was a crucial safety precaution intended to prevent a major accident. Deprived of information about why such rules might be important, the operators went on with their work as usual, ignorant of the potentially catastrophic consequences of breaching them. Meanwhile, every accident that did occur at a nuclear station in the Soviet Union continued to be regarded as a state secret, kept even from the specialists at the installations where they occurred. Early on the evening of September 9, 1982, Nikolai Steinberg was sitting at the desk in his third-floor office between Chernobyl Units 1 and 2, overlooking the vent stack shared by the two reactors. Steinberg, a 35-year-old with a short goatee and an easy charm, had worked in Chernobyl since 1971, arriving straight from the Moscow Power Engineering Institute as a graduate in nuclear thermohydraulics and one of a new breed of bright-eyed Adam Shiki. He had spent more than 2 years studying the RBMK at college before the first of the reactors had even been built, watched the first two units of the Chernobyl plant emerge from the ground, and was now chief of the turbine department for Units 3 and 4. When Steinberg saw steam rising from the top of the vent stack, he knew it meant trouble, a broken pipe inside the reactor at least, and certainly a release of radiation. He picked up the phone. But when he got through to the control room of Unit 1 to warn the operators there to shut down the reactor, the shift supervisor brushed him off. When Steinberg persisted, the supervisor hung up on him. The engineer gathered his staff and waited to be summoned for the emergency, but no call came. Almost 6 hours later, at midnight, he and his men got into their cars and drove home to Pripyat. When he returned to work the following morning, Steinberg heard that there had indeed been a problem in Unit 1, but despite his seniority and experience, could learn nothing further. Director Bruhanov and the chief engineer of the plant initially insisted that whatever had happened had caused no radioactive releases, and local KGB officers took measures to prevent the spread of panic-mongering, provocative rumors, and other negative manifestations. In fact, radioactive contamination carried on the wind and brought down by rain showers had reached Pripyat and spread as far as 14 kilometers from the plant. It included iodine-131, fragments of uranium dioxide fuel, and hot particles containing zinc-65 and zirconium-niobium-95, consistent with partial destruction of the reactor core. Levels of radiation in the village of Chestogolova, 5 kilometers from the station, were hundreds of times higher than normal. But a team from Soyuz Atomenergo, the USSR's Atomic Energy Authority, contested these findings. Contaminated areas immediately around the plant were simply sluiced with water and covered with soil and leaves. In Pripyat, decontamination trucks dispensed foam on the streets, and Lenina Prospect was discreetly spread with a fresh layer of asphalt. A subsequent inquiry revealed that there had been a partial meltdown in Unit 1. When the reactor had been brought back online after maintenance, one of the temperamental cooling valves had remained closed, the uranium fuel in the channel overheated, and it ruptured. No one was killed, but the damage took 8 months to repair. Workers carried blocks of reactor graphite away in buckets and were exposed to significant amounts of radiation. The chief engineer took the blame and was demoted and reassigned to a job in Bulgaria. The incident was classified top secret, and those directly involved were forced to sign gag orders by the KGB. Nikolai Steinberg would wait years before learning the truth about what had happened. In the years that followed, there would be even more serious accidents at nuclear plants elsewhere in the Soviet Union, and all of them would be covered up. In October 1982, a generator exploded at reactor number 1 of the Metsamor plant in Armenia, the turbine hall burned down, and an emergency team had to be airlifted in from the Kola Peninsula, more than 3,000 kilometers away in the Arctic Circle, to help save the core. Less than 3 years later, during the startup of the first reactor at the Balakovo plant in Russia, a relief valve burst and superheated steam at 300 degrees centigrade escaped into the annular compartments surrounding the reactor well. 14 men were boiled alive. Both incidents were concealed, and word reached the operators at other stations only through the Adamshiki rumor mill and hints in Pravda. Yet the most dangerous suppression of all originated once more within Nikiet, the Central Nuclear Design Bureau in Moscow where the RBMK-1000 had been conceived. In 1983, on top of the myriad drawbacks of the reactor that had emerged since it went into production, the reactor designers learned of one more, a curious design fault in the rods of the AZ-5 emergency protection system. The first conclusive evidence appeared at the end of the year, during the physical startup of two of the newest RBMK reactors to be added to the Soviet grid. Unit 1 of the Ignalina nuclear power plant in Lithuania, and Unit 4 in Chernobyl, the most advanced of the RBMK-1000 line. While conducting tests before the two reactors could be brought into normal operation, the startup teams of nuclear engineers in Ignalina and Chernobyl noticed a small but disturbing glitch. When they used the AZ-5 scram button to shut down the reactor, the control rods began their descent into the core, but instead of completing a smooth shutdown, the rods initially had the opposite effect. For a brief moment, reactor power rose instead of falling. The specialists discovered that the severity of this positive scram effect depended on the conditions inside the reactor at the moment the shutdown began, particularly on the ORM, the measurement indicating how many of the 211 control rods were withdrawn from the core. If more than 30 of these rods remained inserted when the scram began, the AZ-5 mechanism worked as intended, and the reactor would shut down quickly and safely. But when the total number of inserted rods fell below 30, the behavior of the reaction at shutdown became increasingly unpredictable, and the AZ-5 system struggled to do its job. With only 15 rods in, the technicians found that initial dampening of fission inside the reactor was marginal. It took 6 seconds before reactivity began to fall. And under some circumstances, 7 rods or fewer, pressing the AZ-5 button might not shut down the reactor at all, but instead trigger a runaway chain reaction. If this happened, the increase in reactor power following an AZ-5 trip might be so great that it would no longer be possible to halt the reaction before the entire reactor was destroyed. The source of the positive scram effect lay in the design of the control rods themselves, an unintended consequence of Nikiet's desire to save neutrons and make the reactor more economical to run. Like all the manual control rods used to manage the reactor during normal operation, the AZ-5 emergency rods contained boron carbide, a neutron poison that gobbles slow neutrons to reduce the chain reaction. But even when fully withdrawn from their water-filled control channels, the tips of the rods were designed to remain at the ready, just inside the active zone of the reactor, where, if they contained boron carbide, they would have a poisoning effect, creating a slight but constant drag on power output. To stop this from happening, the rods were tipped with short lengths of graphite, the neutron moderator that facilitates fission. When a scram shutdown began and the AZ-5 rods began their descent into the control channels, the graphite displaced neutron-absorbing water with the effect of initially increasing the reactivity of the core. Only when the longer boron-filled part of the rod followed the graphite tip through the channel did it begin dampening reactivity. It was an absurd and chilling inversion in the role of a safety device, as if the pedals of a car had been wired in reverse so that hitting the brakes made it accelerate instead of slowing down. With further experiments, the technicians confirmed that the positive scram effect of the rod tips could create local criticality in the lower part of the giant RBMK core, especially if the operators tripped the AZ-5 system when the reactor was running at less than half power. Alarmed, the director of the nuclear reactor department at the Kurchatov Institute wrote to Nikiet detailing the anomalies in the AZ-5 system and the need to examine them more closely. "It seems likely," he warned, "that a more thorough analysis will reveal other dangerous situations." Nikolai Dolezal, the chief designer at Nikiet, replied with vaporous assurances. They were aware of the problem and measures were being taken. But they weren't. Although some partial modifications to the AZ-5 mechanism were approved, even these proved costly and inconvenient and were executed piecemeal, just one RBMK reactor at a time. Gradually, Chernobyl's Units 1, 2, and 3 were approved for the alterations, but Unit 4, already so close to completion, would have to wait for its first scheduled maintenance shutdown in April 1986. In the meantime, Nicky had circulated a notification of the positive SCRAM effect to the senior managers of all RBMK plants. But swept along in a blizzard of bureaucracy, tangled in secrecy, the news never reached the reactor operators. Nonetheless, as far as Anatoly Alexandrov and the other nuclear chiefs were concerned, the redoubtable RBMK-1000, the Soviet national reactor, had been troubled by nothing more than temporary setbacks. By the time Viktor Bruhanov put his final signature on the paperwork to acknowledge completion of the fourth reactor of the V.I. Lenin nuclear power plant on the last day of 1983, the world still spoke of only one nuclear accident, and that humiliation belonged entirely to the United States. Early in the morning of March 28, 1979, a handful of water-purifying resin beads, smaller than mustard seeds, blocked a valve in the secondary coolant loop of Reactor 2 of the Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Station near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Over the next 24 hours, the ensuing cascade of minor equipment malfunctions and human error led to a serious loss of coolant, which partially uncovered the core. The reactor began to melt down and contaminated the containment building with thousands of gallons of radioactive water. The staff had no choice but to vent radioactive gases directly into the atmosphere. Although no one was harmed by the released radiation, contained entirely in a cloud of short-lived isotopes of inert gases that drifted out over the Atlantic Ocean, news of the accident caused widespread panic. The roads of the tri-state area were clogged as 135,000 people fled their homes in Pennsylvania. President Jimmy Carter, who had served as a nuclear engineer in the U.S. Navy and knew a disaster when he saw one, attended the scene. The international anti-nuclear movement, which had slowly been gaining momentum over the previous decade, could not have asked for a more fearsome totem of a dangerous technology slipping its leash. In the United States, the development of the nuclear power industry, already dogged by rising construction costs and growing public apprehension, halted almost overnight. As bad as it made the United States look, news of Three Mile Island was censored inside the USSR for fear it could tarnish the ostensibly spotless record of the peaceful atom. Publicly, Soviet officials attributed the accident to the failings of capitalism. Academician Valery Legasov, Alexandrov's immediate deputy at the Kurchatov Institute, published an article insisting that the events in Three Mile Island were irrelevant to the USSR's nuclear industry because its operators were far better trained and its safety standards higher than those in the United States. Privately, Soviet physicists began to analyze the likelihood of severe accidents at atomic power stations and revised their existing nuclear safety regulations, but neither Sredmash nor Nikiat made any attempt to bring the RBMK reactor into line with these new rules. In January 1986, the new issue of Soviet Life, a glossy English-language magazine resembling the stalwart American title but published by the Soviet Embassy in the United States, featured the Chernobyl nuclear power plant as the centerpiece of a 10-page report on the wonders of nuclear energy. The special section included interviews with the residents of Pripyat, the city born of the atom, color photographs of the plant, and pictures of smiling station staff. Legasov co-authored another essay in which he boasted, "In the 30 years since the first Soviet nuclear power plant opened, there has not been a single instance when plant personnel or nearby residents have been seriously threatened. Not a single disruption in normal operation occurred that would have resulted in the contamination of the air, water, or soil." In a separate interview, Vitaly Sklarov, the Ukrainian Minister of Energy and Electrification, assured readers that the odds of a meltdown at the plant were 1 in 10,000 years. 5. Friday, April 25, 11:55 p.m., Unit Control Room Number 4. Beneath the sickly fluorescent strip lights of Control Room Number 4, a rancid haze of cigarette smoke hung in the air. The midnight shift had only just arrived, but the mood was growing tense. The turbine generator test, scheduled to finish that afternoon, had not yet begun. The station's deputy chief engineer for operations, Anatoly Dyatlov, was now entering his second day without sleep. He was exhausted and unhappy. The test was intended to check a key safety system designed to protect reactor number 4 during an electrical blackout, A total loss of external power providing electricity to the station from the grid was something for which the RBMK designers had planned. It was one scenario of the so-called design basis accident, in which the plant suddenly lost power and the giant coolant pumps that kept water circulating through the reactor core came to a rumbling halt. The station had emergency diesel generators, but it would take between 40 seconds and 3 minutes for these to start up and get the pumps going again. This was a dangerous gap, long enough for a core meltdown to begin. So the reactor designers devised what they called a rundown unit, a mechanism to use the momentum of the unit's turbines to drive the pumps for those crucial seconds. The rundown unit was a crucial safety feature of reactor number 4 and was supposed to have been tested before it was approved for use in December 1983. But Director Bruhanov had granted approval to skip the test to meet his end-of-year deadline. And although similar trials had been attempted since, they had failed each time. By the beginning of 1986, the test was more than 2 years overdue, but the reactor's first scheduled maintenance shutdown offered an opportunity to conduct the trial in real-world conditions. At 2 o'clock on Friday afternoon, with new modifications made to one of the unit's two huge turbine generators, turbine number 8, it had, at last, been ready to begin. But then, the central dispatcher of the Kiev electrical grid intervened. Factories and enterprises throughout Ukraine were still in a frenzy of last-minute activity to meet their production quotas and win bonuses before the May Day holiday, and they needed every kilowatt of electricity the Chernobyl nuclear power plant could supply. The dispatcher said that Unit 4 could not go offline to begin the test until after the peak load had passed, 9 p.m. at the earliest. By midnight on Friday, the team of electrical engineers waiting to monitor the test were threatening to cancel their contract and return to Donetsk if it didn't start soon. In control room number 4, the staff who had been briefed on the test program had reached the end of their shift and were preparing to go home. And the physicist from the plant's nuclear safety department, expected to be on hand to help the reactor operator through his part in the test, had been told the experiment was already complete. He hadn't shown up at all. Stepping up to the instruments on the senior reactor control engineer's desk, 25-year-old Leonid Toptanov, just 2 months into his new job, prepared to pilot the capricious reactor through a shutdown for the first time in his life. But Deputy Chief Engineer Dyatlov was determined to press on. If the test wasn't completed that night, it would have to wait at least another year, and Dyatlov didn't like to wait. At 55, Anatoly Dyatlov looked every inch the austere Soviet technocrat. Tall and gaunt, with sharp cheekbones, sparse gray hair swept straight back from his high forehead, and narrow Siberian eyes that, even in photographs, seemed to glint with malice. A veteran physicist who had come to Chernobyl after 14 years working on naval reactors in the Soviet Far East, Dyatlov was one of the three most senior managers at the station with nuclear expertise. He oversaw the operation of both Units 3 and 4, with responsibility for hiring and training personnel. The son of a peasant who had lit the buoys each night on the Yenisei River near the penal settlements of Krasnoyarsk, Dyatlov had run away from home at 14. He went to vocational school and worked as an electrician before winning a place at MIFI, the Moscow Engineering and Physics Institute. He graduated in 1959 and was posted to a stronghold of the Soviet military-industrial complex, the Lenin Komsomol shipyard in the remote city of Komsomolsk-on-Amur. As the head of the classified Laboratory 23, Dyatlov managed a team of 20 men who installed the reactors of the Yankee and Victor-class nuclear-powered submarines before they put to sea. By the time he arrived in Chernobyl in 1973, he had overseen the assembling, testing, and commissioning of more than 40 VM reactor cores. These small marine reactors, versions of the Vivier, were nothing like the massive graphite-moderated behemoths being constructed in Chernobyl. But Dyatlov, a fanatical specialist, threw himself into learning everything he could about the RBMK-1000. He was there for the commissioning of each one of the 4 new units in Chernobyl, and now worked 10-hour days, 6 and sometimes 7 days a week. He walked to the plant every day from his home in Pripyat. He found that walking helped to keep dark thoughts at bay, and jogged to keep fit. He was rarely in his office, but prowled the corridors and gangways of the plant day and night, inspecting the equipment, checking for leaks and errant vibrations, and keeping tabs on his staff. A stickler for detail, Dyatlov knew his job and prided himself on his knowledge of the reactor and its systems. of mathematics, physics, mechanics, thermodynamics, and electrical engineering. But the manner Dyatlov had developed while running a top-secret military laboratory did not prepare him well for managing the operators and engineers of a civilian nuclear power station. He had no tolerance for shirkers or those who didn't follow his orders to the letter. Even those colleagues he brought with him from Komsomolsk found him hard to work with. He could be high-handed and peremptory, peppering his speech with curses and Soviet Navy slang, muttering to himself about the inexperienced technicians he dismissed as Chertov Karas, fucking goldfish. He demanded that any fault he discovered be fixed immediately and carried a notebook in which he recorded the names of those who failed to meet his standards. The deputy chief engineer believed he was always right and held stubbornly to his own convictions on technical matters, even when overruled from above. And Dyatlov's long experience in the shipyard and the chimerical construction targets imposed in Chernobyl had taught him that the categorical dictates of Soviet bureaucracy and the gray netherworld of Soviet reality were very different things. Dyatlov had fulfilled every autodidactic expectation of Soviet man, dedicating himself to his work by day and steeping himself in culture by night. He loved poetry and knew by heart all 8 chapters of Pushkin's epic Eugene Onegin. Away from work, he could be good company, though he had few close friends. Only long afterward would his secret emerge. Before arriving in Chernobyl, Dyatlov had been involved in a reactor accident in Laboratory 23. There was an explosion, and Dyatlov was exposed to 100 rem, a huge dose of radiation. The accident, inevitably, was covered up. Later, one of his 2 young sons developed leukemia. There could be no certainty that the 2 events were linked, but the boy was 9 when he died, and Dyatlov buried him there beside the river in Komsomolsk. Although the specialists who labored under Dyatlov at the Chernobyl plant may have disliked the way he treated them, many admired him, and few doubted his expertise. Eager to learn, they believed that he knew everything there was to know about reactors, and by crushing dissent and conjuring an air of infallibility, Dyatlov, like the Soviet state itself, expected his underlings to carry out his commands with robotic acquiescence, regardless of their better judgment. Yet the deputy chief engineer admitted a peculiar reservation about the reactor on which they all worked. For all his hours spent poring over the latest technical revisions and regulations, for all his mastery of thermodynamics and physics, Dyatlov said that there remained something unfathomable about the RBMK-1000, a nuclear enigma even he could never fully understand. The control room of Unit 4 was a large, windowless box, around 20 meters wide and 10 meters deep, with a polished stone floor and a low suspended ceiling punctuated by the recessed fluorescent lights and ventilation ducts. Usually, it was manned by a team of just 4. At the back, the shift foreman had his own desk, from where he could observe the 3 operators who ran the unit, stationed at 3 long gray steel control panels arranged in a broken arc across the width of the room. On the left sat the senior reactor control engineer, known by the Russian acronym SUR. On the right was the senior turbine control engineer. And in the center, linking the activity of the other 2, the senior unit control engineer, who maintained the water supply that kept it all going. Hundreds of thousands of cubic meters of it, flowing around the reactor's primary loop, from the pumps, through the reactor, to the steam generators, out to the turbines, and back again. The 3 men's control panels were festooned with the hundreds of switches, buttons, gauges, lamps, and annunciator alarms needed to manage the primary processes of spinning electricity from nuclear fission. Forming a wall in front of the desks was a floor-to-ceiling bank of instrument panels showing the status of all 3 of the systems on illuminated dials, closed-circuit TV screens, and trembling pentrace drums, which slowly logged data across scrolling bands of paper. Concealed beneath the panel and in the anterooms to the left and right were thousands of meters of cable leading away into darkness and banks of computer cabinets filled with glowing valves and clicking relays, the complex but antiquated technology that linked the control panels to the reactor itself. As young Leonid Toptunov took over at the senior reactor control engineer's desk, he faced 2 giant backlit displays reaching almost to the ceiling and showing the operating conditions within reactor number 4. One displayed the status of every one of its 1,659 uranium-filled fuel channels. The other was formed of 211 glowing dials arranged in a circle 3 meters across. These were the Selsun monitors, which indicated the position of the boron carbide control rods that could be raised or lowered into the reactor to moderate its chain reaction. Beneath Toptanov's hands lay the panel of switches with which he could select groups of rods and the joystick that moved them in and out of the core. Nearby, a reactimeter showed the